that spurs me. The research that I do is not for the famous cattlemen, not for the famous ranchers, not the famous. It's those who are unnamed and unknown, who are buried in graves from South Texas, Northern Mexico, all the way up to Western Canada. We'll never know their names, but there's incredible nobility in the sacrifices they made to build this great country. And I mean that literally.
Hi, I'm Wyatt.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Moore. We're back with our Experts Corner interviews with experts typically in the real estate world and short-term rental investing world. Today, I've got a real treat for you, and I'm really excited about the conversation we're going to have with Mr. Michael Grauer. And Michael is a historian focused on cowboy history. And so, Michael, I'm super excited because I always brag about the cowboy way around here around at Odyssey. But now I'm going to really talk to somebody who knows if I even know what I'm talking about, right? And so thanks so much for joining us today, Michael. I'm excited about this conversation.
I'm honored that you invited me to come on your show. It's something I'm passionate about. It's the history of and art and cultures in the American West, and focusing on cowboy history, especially to get the story right, because there's so much wrong and misunderstood about what a cowboy really was and is.
Yes. And I have some definite questions to make sure that, some are curious questions for me. Some are, is the movies that I love so much, are they accurate at all? And so we're going to dive into some of that. But before we do, tell me your backstory. Tell me where you grew up, what background we had, and what led us into this world of cowboy history for you.
Well, I'm a native Kansan and grew up in little towns in Kansas and Missouri, and then reared the later part of growing up years in north of the river in Kansas City. Dad was a farm kid from northeastern Kansas, and mom was a kid from St. Joe and eventually Kansas City, Kansas. And I grew up going to my grandfather's farm up in northeastern Kansas at Marysville, Kansas. And that's where I was first introduced to horses in the flesh. And my earliest memories are getting up before anybody else was up and going and hanging over the fence on the horse corrals, waiting for somebody to get up and put me on a horse because I was too little to get on by myself. So that's all I ever wanted to be, was a cowboy. And of course, grew up with all the TV shows in the 60s and 70s, et cetera. And eventually, undergrad at the University of Kansas, Rock Chalk. I had an internship and eventually turned into a job at Smithsonian American Art Museum for a couple of years. And I worked in their exhibits department, and then graduate school at Southern Methodist University, Go Ponies. And then eventually became the curator of art and Western heritage at the Panhandle Plains Historical Museum out in Canyon, Texas. Texas' largest history museum, 300,000 square feet, about 3 million artifacts. Wow. I got to say grace over some great collections. Charles Goodnight, very famous Western character and cattleman, and also Quanah Parker's collection is there, and so on. Considered one of the finest working ranch collections in the world, frankly. And then for 6 years, I was at the National Cowboy Museum in Oklahoma City, where I was the curator of cowboy collections in Western art. So there's something kind of cool about being the cowboy historian at the National Cowboy Museum, and I'm pretty proud of that. Meanwhile, I also did some additional graduate work at West Texas A&M University there in Canyon. Anyway, being around horses is something I always wanted to do and always was. And working cows and all that stuff are stories that we need to talk about and get accurate, because there's so much that's misunderstood. And I think one of the things that I want to make sure people understand is that cowboys built America along with farmers. And I say this all the time. This great country was built on beef and bread. It wasn't built on broccoli. So we need to remember that.
It's you and I could I love the history of it. And I always say around Odyssey, first I always say, we put the cowboy way on our wall, and the cowboy way to us is just this a way of life of personal responsibility, self-reliance, mm-hmm. Going out, like really extreme ownership of saying, hey, listen, we're going to go out and make things happen. And if it's going to happen, we're going to make it happen. And
absolutely.
And it's what we like love around here. I think it stems in when you look back, and I feel like cowboys and cowgirls and the Western lifestyle has become really popular lately. You know, there's a guy named Taylor Sheridan that kind of put a lot of that, back into the movies and on the map. And I think he's done a good job of just saying, hey, listen, we're kind of looking back and saying where did we come from? How did this grow up? But when I look at like cowboys, for example, and the term cowboy, you think of all these different things that, cowboy and cowgirls mean different things to different people. And some of it is fantasy. Some of it is like, hey, what do we think about? One of my favorite movies, I don't even know if it's accurate or not historically accurate, but I love Tombstone. And I'm sure that just like every movie, there's stories in it that are just completely inaccurate. But I've always been curious watching that, and I've never really looked into the answer of it. Is the cowboys then were this outlaw gang? They were called the Cowboys. Remember the red sashes and
right.
Was there any truth to any of that, or is that like was the term cowboy? Where did it come from?
Yeah, the term cowboy at that time in the 19th century, when all the events take place in Tombstone, a cowboy was. To call someone a cowboy was fairly derogatory, and it was usually associated with a criminal. And that's what the cowboys were, this gang in that part of Arizona, were all criminals. They were thieves. They were murderers. They committed cattle theft without any reservation whatsoever. And so that, someone referred to as a cowboy was usually immediately considered to be an unsavory character, a thief, at least a murderer at worst. And those guys were all of that. However, on the other hand, we need to remember that the Earps weren't cowboys. They may have worn Western hats. And this is what I always, whenever I talk about cowboys or give a presentation on cowboy history, first thing I ask the studio audience is usually, what do you call a man in a Western hat? And nearly everybody says a cowboy. And I said, no, that's a man in a Western hat.
Yeah.
And so we need to remember that everything we know about Tombstone today is based on popular culture. And we also need to remember any witness to the gunfight at the OK Corral, as it's come to be known, had an agenda. Either they were for the Earps, or they were against the Earps, or they just wanted their town back. And, the Earps were a bunch of criminals, too. People forget that, not to get too graphic about it, but they'd all been arrested, every one of them, for some sort of criminal activity, meaning the Earps. And of course, Doc Holliday, pretty unsavory character in his own right, but they've been heroicized. And great film. Don't get me wrong. Love Tombstone. Anytime it comes on, you stop what you're doing, you watch Tombstone. Because Val Kilmer completely stole the show. I mean, he did. But Val Kilmer's interpretation of Doc Holliday is not very, very close to the truth. And in fact, you want to get split. And here's Dennis Quaid's portrayal of Doc Holliday in the Kevin Costner version of that. The White Earp film is probably closer to the truth, because he was tubercular. He was notoriously ill-tempered. He was an alcoholic, all kinds of things. So, but getting back to your original question, yes, that outlaw gang called the Cowboys was really pretty consistent with how people see that word. And, as long as there have been domesticated cattle, at least 5,000 years ago or longer, there were often tended by small children, and some of those children might take a few head of cattle to market. Let's say we're in Europe, in the 14th century, a few head of cattle taken to market by a small boy. He was the cowboy, or he could be a girl, and it's the cowgirl who put, half dozen head to market on foot using a stick. That's also true in Africa, wherever you are. However you say cowboy in any particular language. So for, it was a designation of a job set, a skill set, so to speak. During the American Revolution, there were British cattle thieves, also called cowboys. And they were rustlers. So they were a criminal element. And then fast forward to the famous cattle drives that really bring the cowboy to the American and ultimately the world consciousness. They weren't called, the men doing those cattle drives weren't called cowboys, they're called drovers. That was a standard name for someone who did that. And cowboy really only becomes an acceptable term roughly after 1880 or so. And it's really through popular culture that this sometimes called the knight errant of the plains, let's say, using one quotation, becomes a symbol that I have from my own personal experience, because I've worked on exhibits on cowboys literally internationally. It's the most recognizable symbol in the world, and it represents liberty and freedom. Because a man on horseback literally changes his geography, literally. And being on horseback means you can get away fast. You can get where you want to go. But if you get into that story, that man on horseback that drove on cattle drive didn't own his own horse. The droving crew owned the horse. So, you know, you can get into those nuances, but the main thing to remember is that the cowboy becomes a worldwide symbol, far greater recognized and embraced than any other symbol in world history. Now, there are those who want to shoot that down, but in my experience, and that's direct experience, the cowboy is recognized. But there was a time in that trail driving story where there were attempts to paint the cowboy as an unsavory character and to support that. And that's literally because when those droves of cattle, those giant herds are coming out of Texas and being taken to those Kansas cow towns and eventually Nebraska cow towns, Wyoming, Colorado, all the way up to Montana and Western Canada, those doctors and lawyers and such in those old town, in those towns, started to realize that the females of the species, those in residence in those towns, thought those riders on horseback, as dirty and smelly as they were, looked pretty darn interesting. And what I believe there was a propaganda campaign, and I can prove this with, you know, press releases, and nothing in the media is ever propaganda, of course.
Right, never, right?
Yeah, there were efforts to paint them as all as drunk criminals, and that was born out of fear, because nobody wanted your wife or your daughter or your niece or your mama to run away with one of these guys. But it happened. You know, they look pretty good on the back of a horse, as dirty as and nasty as they were. You know, once they got cleaned and slicked up, they looked pretty good. And there was great fear in those towns from those doctors and lawyers and such that Willie and Waylon sing about.
Yeah, they were going to come in and take all the ladies, right?
You bet. Absolutely. Yeah.
It was, it's funny. I always say I wear a cowboy hat almost every day, and
good for you.
I'm the furthest thing from an actual cowboy. I would tell people, because people are always, hey, you're cowboy. I mean, I have a couple Highland cows, you know, in the backyard. Yeah. I have a little petting zoo more than anything, but to your point, it's just a man in a Western hat. Right. And so it's, I love the character of the cowboy that I've painted in my mind. Right. And I love what it stands for. I love, you know, I'm a diehard patriot, and I feel like that it is the backbone of America. And just, I feel like, but I've always heard or thought that, and I even watching Tombstone, I'm like, man, cowboys are the term cowboy was fairly derogatory back then. Yep. And then it's switched and become something different. Right. How much of, you know, because when I like growing up and loving the cowboys and loving that, like I started really liking like the rodeo scene, right? And and rodeo was like kind of my first introduction to what I would call a cowboy, right? And watching the guys and you know, ride the horses and ride the bulls and all that stuff. And but you know, really the rodeo scene is not really what defines the cowboy, right? I mean, that's not like far from it. And when you really think about it, that was my introduction of what, like when I was little thinking, oh, that looks really fun. That's awesome. I like those guys. You know, I looked up to them. When did that become like associated to like I mean, it's always kind of probably been the Western side of life when you're breaking the horses and everything else, but really a cowboy and the rancher and the farmer is, it's cattle, right? It's a cattle business.
Right. And that's an important distinction people have forgotten. It's a business, and it was always a business, and it was heavily documented. And the care of the product was put in the hands of people who didn't own the product. And those people, we call them cowboys. And that's one of the great admirable qualities of a true cowboy is they're responsible for somebody else's property that they buy by the way they conduct themselves, whether that be on a roundup or on a trail drive or whatever. It reflects on them and their character, how well they take care of that bovine or that horse or mule or whatever it is. That reflects on them. And they took great pride in that to make sure you get the herd to where it's supposed to go, or you conduct the roundup in a responsible way where that product will reflect well on that person who hired you. There's an old expression called he'll make a hand. That means somebody who's really going to do the job that they signed on to do, not going to shirk responsibility, but are going to fully embrace it, knowing full well that they're not going to reap much benefit through the sale of those animals at the end of the trail, at the end of the roundup, except to earn the wages they signed on to. And here's the interesting thing. One of the many interesting things is the average wage for a cowboy between 1880 and 1930 was $1 a day, $1 a day. And you think about that, and they didn't own their horse. They owned their personal clothing, their saddle, bridle, a couple of ropes typically, and that's it. Because when you signed on to use the stock that was available. And that included creating a tool out of a horse that was in the best scenario was what they call green broke, which means it barely was broke to saddle. That's why in the famous Western artists paintings like Charlie Russell and Frederick Remington, you have scenes like Charlie Russell called Bronc for Breakfast, because every morning was a rodeo.
Yeah.
So circling around to your question about rodeo, rodeos in many cases was most people's entree to the cowboy world, but it's an imitation of horse and cow work. If you can't get to a ranch, I strongly recommend anyone to go see a ranch rodeo. That's where you'll see the closest you'll ever get to true horse and cow work. Professional rodeo is ultimately it's a show. It's to put on an entertainment. And I don't mean that in any way to disparage any of those competitors at all. But it's the descendant of the Wild West shows, professional rodeo. That's just the facts. Ranch rodeo, on the other hand, is derived from those first rodeos. And I'm going to take you way back in history, 300 years, 400 years. Held in Mexico in the 1530s. Now you think about that, 300 years before the first rodeos are being held in the United States, in Colorado, as a matter of fact, Colorado Territory, I think it's a deer trail, Colorado, is the first recognized rodeo in the 1860s. So 300 years before that, you have, by Spanish law, because this was still Spain, New Spain at that time, you were required to brand your cattle, mark your cattle, earmark them, gather them up every year at a rodeo, which today we translate as roundup. Mm-hmm. And you, during that time, there was a party at the end of the roundup, a fiesta, which also included a competition between the ranch owners, the hacendados, and the workers, the vaqueros. In other words, you had to compete against your boss, right? And that's where you get the competition today we know as rodeo. So there were roping events, there were bronc riding events. Now, it was one of the few times they actually would get on a bull, because there was always a bull that was going to be sacrificed for everybody to eat. So they rode that bull until he collapsed, and then you butchered him and put him on the spit. But bull riding, absolutely forbidden. You get caught riding a bull in the 19th century in the United States, they just fire you. I mean, those bulls were incredibly valuable.
Right.
And today, of course, you have bulls that are bred for bucking. That's a whole different thing.
Right. Completely different. I've actually been to, I love, you know, the entertaining sports side of the rodeos, but I've been to three different ranch rodeos, and super entertaining and interesting in their own, you know, in their own right. And so it is, I would definitely second that. If you've never been to a ranch rodeo, it is pretty fun to go watch the horsemanship and the cowmanship, and just being able to watch them with these animals. It's pretty fun.
and a whole different audience set, right?
Yes.
And it's you know, because everybody goes to whatever rodeo it is, wearing their hats and their boots and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But you go to ranch rodeo, it's very, very family oriented and very faith oriented and patriotism. Not saying it's not on display, because it is in all rodeo, but there it's on a whole different level, a purer level, you might say.
Right.
And that's part of it, is the whole thing that you see at ranch rodeo.
Right. Right. It's one of the, in fact, I always tell my wife and kids, when we go to those, I said, when I go to those, it's not even like, it's the feeling you get around like the foundation of just like, okay, this feels like pure, right? It feels like this is like with faith and family and patriotism and, you know, all of that like lumped into one, and you just feel it. And that's what, one of the things I love the most about it is just that.
Absolutely. And I'd encourage everyone to look into going to the World Championships in Amarillo in November, because it is, you know, that's the top ranch teams that'll be there. I just happened to be in Alpine, Texas a few weeks ago at the ranch rodeo down there, and mm-hmm. went to some ranch rodeos in Oklahoma and also in other places. But it's a whole different feel than you will find, let's say, at the NFR in Las Vegas. Completely different thing, or some of these other competitions. So yeah. You're exactly right. You nailed it.
Talk to me about one of the things that I love the most when we're talking, as we're talking about that feel and that kind of the belief, like we say, of that self-reliance, personal responsibility, like just, you know, they always, you know, the cliche term of, you know, just saddling up when you're scared to death and doing it anyway. Right. All that stuff. But that stuff internalizes to me, which we try to pull into our everyday lives. What is when you think about that, and I've read different things that say the code of the West, is there actually, as a historian, is there really a code of the West? I've seen a multiple ones written out that are all fairly similar.
Yes.
Was there actually a code of the West?
You know, it's an unwritten thing, but it's often credited to the Western writer, Zane Grey. He published his version of it. And that's important to remember. Everybody had their own version. And there's a lot of consistency in the versions.
Right.
And you see them on plaques and truck stops and everywhere else today. And there are those from a certain particular stripe who want to turn it into a cliche. But people in the Western world, I would say, in general, who follow that cowboy culture, the cowboy way, that it's not a placard on the wall. It's how they conduct
how
themselves.
You live in. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And so it's easy to say, it's much harder to do. And that's, you know, says easy, does hard. And those people in the cow country, they believe it and they do it. And they don't whip it out and show it in their, you know, the card in their wallet, or they don't wear a t-shirt. They might wear a t-shirt. I don't know. But, generally it's just how they conduct themselves. It's not easy to follow that code. It's a personal code, but it's also a cultural code, I think you could say. So yeah. I think there's I've never seen it written down in the 19th century, but it really, Zane Grey sort of codified it, let's say, in the 20s, 1920s.
And I love that you highlighted, it's not something you throw on your license plate or anything else. It's very much a, hey, this is how we're going to live our life. And that's what, to me, that cowboy way really means. It's like, hey, this is pretty easy to talk about. It's pretty easy to say. There's a lot of things that can be cliche about it.
Right.
Go out and do it every single day, and every decision you make, and how you conduct yourself on a regular basis. It's a lot harder to do. And I think that that's what's so, so intriguing to me, I guess, right, is to be able to say, am I living up to this standard, right? And because that's really what it is. You're setting a standard for how you want to live, how you want to conduct yourself, how you want to, who you want to surround yourself with. And it does feel like when you are in those certain circles that it is this unwritten law that has been kind of written down over the years now, but it does feel like that there's that element of the way that people are living in certain circles.
Yeah, no question about it. You know, if you're around ranch hands in particular, and I don't mean in competition or anything like that, but if you're around them, you know, say you're at the cafe in some small West Texas town or wherever, they conduct themselves a certain way. There's clearly a code that they follow, you know, open the door for a woman. And you know, you treasure little children and those things that are smaller than you. Tell the truth, all the things. Say, mean what you say, and do what you say. You know,
yeah.
All those things are there, and all you have to do is just be a fly on the wall, and you'll see it. Yeah. And guess what? They're not posting it on Facebook. Look at me. I just followed the code of the West. They're not putting it, they're not sending out an instant message. Look at me. Here's a picture of me on TikTok following the code of the West. You know, it says easy and does hard. It really does. And, that's, I think where it becomes cliche and trite is when you stick it on that sort of thing and don't follow it at all. I mean, yeah. There are plenty of people who want to talk about it, but they don't actually follow it.
Right. Right. What, as you know, I'm sure you've come across so many different stories and so many different, you know, things that you've uncovered over the years of just, you know, learning about all this stuff and being interested in it, wrapping your, you know, really your life around it. If there, like, are there untold stories that sometimes some of your favorites or one of your favorites that you like to share with people that are, get their information from watching movies, right? And Hollywood, right. And everything else. Like, is there something like, is there something that comes to mind of like an untold, you know, story or something you uncovered? You're like, man, I wish more people knew this.
Well, two things come to mind. One is, do what needs doing is one of those subtexts of the Cowboy Code. And one of the things in my experiences in the story, and I got very interested in World War I. I've always been a Civil War buff, you know, growing up where I did. And, but I got deeply interested in during the lead up to the centennial of World War I, to the point where I went back to grad school at age 56 to write a thesis on soldiers, sailors, Marines, and nurses, et cetera, in the Texas Panhandle and surrounding four states. And eventually curated an exhibit about that. And then a second one called Cowboys in Khaki. And what I learned is that cowboys and Native Americans are frequently the first to sign up because they know what needs doing. And in World War I, for example, many of those cowboys, of course, all presumed they were going to be assigned to cavalry units. Invariably, they got sent to infantry. Or if they got lucky, they were in artillery units that still used horses or mules. But nevertheless, they took their service as a point of pride, but they always made sure you knew that they were Western men and Western women too. Don't get me wrong. And so, you know, the Western divisions, took pride in the fact that when our soldiers arrived in France, they're all wearing what we call a Smokey Bear hat. Now, that's the standard campaign hat for the American Expeditionary Forces. And when they got off the boats, the French said, hooray, the cowboys are here. They're here to save the day. And of course that's largely a popular culture, but we did. And Western divisions were right at the head of that. And one particular story from, I believe it was the Matador Ranch down in West Texas. There was this big cowboy who signed up for service, in the U.S. Army and, let it be known to his wagon boss that, you know, I'm not sure I'll be able to measure up when they talk about going over the top or coming out of the trenches. I don't think I will. And the wagon boss said, no, you're going to be fine. You're going to acquit yourself quite well. And when he went over to France, he was wounded. And I can't remember for sure. I think he lost a leg, but they still hired him back. And I'll never forget this quotation when they wrote about him. He still could sit a horse and the foot fit the saddle fit the stirrup just fine. And I mean, that's just a poignant story. And the second one is, I believe it was 2016. There were terrible grass fires across the Texas Panhandle up into Kansas and Western Oklahoma and some other places. And there were three cowboys, one of whom was a woman. One of them was a small rancher and the other one was a ranch hand. And the ranch hand, he was a young man in his 20s, early 20s. And the small rancher was, I think, in the 30s. He had a young child and recently married. And the other hand had just gotten engaged. And when the fires came, they did what all cowboys do. They went to take care of the cows. All three of them burned to death, including the fiance. And they only knew where they were, some semblance of where to find them. When the one surviving horse came back with the saddle burned to a crisp on its back, and they tracked that horse back and found one of them still alive. And one of the things they inquired, were the cows okay? And I'm sorry, it makes me emotional just even think about that they are so responsible. Yeah. And I think this is to the letter, to the man, to the woman, that they take that responsibility very, very, they don't take it lightly. I mean, it's in their core. And the fact that they did that and then died, that spurs me, the research that I do is not for the famous cattlemen, not for the famous ranchers, not the famous. It's those who are unnamed and unknown, who are buried in graves from South Texas, Northern Mexico, all the way up to Western Canada. We'll never know their names, but there's incredible nobility in the sacrifices they made to build this great country. And I mean that literally. So I tell school children all the time, next time you eat a cheeseburger, you thank God and you thank a cowboy, because whether that's cowboys of male or female, somebody somewhere, some person on horseback, was managing that to eventually feed you there. So they ultimately in the food building business, and then ultimately in the nation building business. So that's what interests me, are the unnamed ones that are buried in those graves. We don't even know where.
I love it. I got chills when you're saying that story, just for when you think about, it's like, nobody's going to know who they are. Nobody's going to write about them in the storybooks. We end up enjoying the fruits of their labor, and they are so committed to that, and they're so bought into that lifestyle that it's like, hey, listen, I'm going to do something for somebody else. And the care that they take with the cattle, I think that's lost as well. On, like, to your point, they're going to their own detriment to save the cattle from the fire. Right. And I mean, the love that they have for those animals and is a lot, I think, lost on a lot of people, of how much care there is, in their hearts to really make sure that that they're protected and they're taken care of. And ultimately, you know, helping all of us, you know, with like food and everything else. Right. But it's
absolutely,
it's a very thankless job that is, some of us, try to think about it a little bit here and there. Right. And I love that you're really trying to get more and more people thinking about that. And that, just that, again, it's just the lifestyle. It's the way of doing things. It's, you gotta like do those things that need to get done, like you say. And it's, and that's not always easy. It's easy to talk about, not always easy to do.
That's so, exactly right. And the same thing holds true for a farmer. They're the same exactly. way. Yeah. They don't get days off. They don't go to the urgent care center when they have a hangnail or a tummy ache. Yeah. They still have to work. And I've got this great book called Saddling Up Anyway, and that can be climbing into a tractor or climbing on the back of a horse. You know, if they don't do what they do, then ultimately down the line, somebody suffers. And exactly. So by that same token, while you're eating that cheeseburger, there's a farmer somewhere in a wheat field who grew some wheat to make that bread that you're eating on your cheeseburger. Yeah. And so, you know, it really embraces all of agriculture, and, you know, food making is the basis for any great society. And the fact that we had such a great foundation in this country based on, you know, wheat fields and beef cattle. And of course, there are variations on anything. That's a critical thing to know. When a society succeeds, it succeeds because its nutritional requirements have been met on a profound way. And we forget that, you know.
Yeah.
We don't
for granted, right? We just assume it's there, and it like we don't realize what it took to get that, you know.
Exactly. We don't build a house from the top down. Right. We build it from the foundation up, and the foundation is food. And you know, so you're exactly right. It has been taken for granted. And here's where it gets really skewed, and I get I'm pretty passionate about it, obviously. But the fact that popular culture has painted a cowboy as a gunman, Yes. Drives me absolutely insane because, and just for full disclosure, I am a gun owner. I got a whole house full of guns. I hunt, self-protection, personal protection, all that stuff. But a firearm in the back of a horse is just not very smart. And it's in mostly it's useless. But in the movies that we see, everybody's got a, you know, strapped on smoke wagon somewhere. Yeah. And it's in terms of history, it's just not, it's just a false narrative. It's not true. Most cowboys carried a saddle gun primarily for predators or varmints of some type. And likewise, you know, the old saw about cowboys and Indians having fights almost never happened. It was rare. I mean, that was the army having the fights with native people and so on. And people carrying guns were either lawmen or criminals. There were laws against carrying open carry in the Kansas cow towns, for example, every one of them, because most of these cowboys were just young men. Some of them were just kids. And, you know, if you gave a 15 year old kid some brown liquor and a firearm, what do you think's going to happen?
Right.
You know, so it's a bunch of nonsense. It's just not true. You know,
some of those misconceptions historically, there's just like, it doesn't work, right? I have horses and we ride horses. I hunt, right? And I'm like, man, I've never ever thought of shooting a gun off the back of a horse ever. You know, it's not
by necessity. You might if there was
but you're not just doing it for sport.
Mm-mm. No. And you know what? The other thing I like to say is a far better story if you just tell the truth.
Right.
I mean, think of the hardships without that. If all they did, all you showed was the truth. It's an epic that's bigger than any story, any American story, frankly. It truly is.
Yeah, you know, absolutely.
How hard it was to do a cattle drive from, you know, Lonesome Dove got it pretty decent. I mean, the interesting thing about that film and book, the novel, we have to remember the novel, one of my favorite novels, I've read it 7 different times, is that at the very beginning, Augustus McCrae says to Woodrow Call, "We're not cattlemen. We're Texas Rangers. We're basically fighters. You're trying to make us cattlemen. We don't even know anything about cows."
Right.
You know, and then suddenly they're all cowboys. Well, you know, they had to hire cowboys to do that work. And it's a fascinating, when you really break it down like that, it's pretty fascinating. And a great, great miniseries, of course.
Oh, I love Lonesome Dove. It's by far my number one Western that I've ever, I mean, I've actually never read the novel, but I've watched the movie at least 7 or 8 times. And it's long, right? It's a long, like I, in fact, I was telling Teresa and the kids, let's watch Lonesome Dove. And they're like, oh, let's throw on Tombstone because it's shorter. Right? But it's, I love Lonesome Dove. Michael, one last question. I want,
yes, sir.
I'm curious.
Yes, sir.
If you could, you know, summon one of the greats, somebody that's passed on, cowboy of the past that you could sit down and have a conversation with. I'm curious who it would be.
Well, Charles Goodnight is near the top because he was a great raconteur. He's notoriously profane, and for example, that's not why. But you know, okay, so there was a cowboy who grew up in a cowboy family, a ranch family. His name was Walter Reumans. Walter Reumans' father was a ranch hand on the famous J.A. Ranch. I think he cowboyed for Charles Goodnight, and I think he was on the trail, on the Goodnight Loving Trail that went down to famous Horsehead Crossing down on the Pecos River, mm-hmm. and then they looped back, if I'm not mistaken. I know Walter better than I do his dad. Anyway, Walter followed in his dad's footsteps, and then he was drafted into the army in World War I, became a machine gunner, came back, survived the war, came back and went right back to being a cowboy. That's all he knew, all he wanted to know, and eventually ended up out in Arizona. And he was ironically killed by a mossy horned steer that dragged him off a cliff and crushed his skull. Lived after, you know, a few days in the hospital, eventually succumbed to the injuries. But he'd been piled up so many times, been broken up so many times in different cow and horse wrecks. I just like to say, what made you keep going? And right. And I suspect I know the answer. you know, he loved the life. You know, there's a great line from Lonesome Dove where Josh Dietz asks Augustus McCrae, you know, what are we doing up here, Captain? This ain't our country. And Augustus McCrae, there's nothing better than seeing a new country on a fine horse.
Yeah.
And I think Walter Reumans would say that. I just want to see what's over the next hill, you know, and it was cowboying and still is, because their cowboys get killed even today and people don't even know that. And I don't mean in rodeo, I mean in ranch work. You know, it's dangerous, it's dirty, the pay's terrible. The food's better than it used to be, for example. But the main thing is it's unpredictable. Yeah. Because you're on the back of an animal that is not your friend. Trigger didn't love Roy. Champion didn't love Gene Autry. They're animals, and they are completely unpredictable, as are cattle. You know, you never know what they're going to do. So you're just as likely to end up on the ground as you are to, you know, to finish the drive or finish the roundup, and getting dragged off a cliff by a mossy horn steer out in the middle of nowhere. So, you know, that's a long way to answer your question, but I'd like to ask Walter Reumans, you know, what it was like to be a cowboy and then suddenly train to be a machine gunner, shipped to France, and then come right back and you just saddle up again, you know?
Yeah. I love that. I love the story behind it too, of why. And, you know, and I think you're right on. I mean, like you said, it's hard work, pays horrible. Very, very underappreciated. All those different things. Why do you keep doing it, right? And I think that there's a gene that they have, those cowboys and cowgirls that they're saying, hey, listen, I like the unpredictability. I like waking up and not knowing what today is going to dish out to me. And I think that there's something absolutely there for the probably it where most of them would say, that you know, there's that keeps it interesting, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. Awesome.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Vacation Rental Revolution podcast. Share this with other people you think need to hear about it. And don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. Hey Grace, is there a website? Yes! For more amazing content and expert advice, visit Vodacy.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.